Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 167th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Steve Perong and T. Lamb. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got writer Doyle. He's the writer-director of the new Netflix show Bonding, and he also plays Nick on Barry. He's one of the acting class guys. The one who spends the beginning of his monologue this season with his head in the toilet.
Yeah. This conversation was awesome. I mean, to me, one of the fascinating things is people always ask about web series turning into TV shows, and we always just have to go back to like High Maintenance or Drunk History or something from like 10 years ago. But it's something that Ryder did very recently, this year.
Yeah.
It started out as a web series, and when it got bought by Netflix, they didn't even change the episode lengths. They're like 10 to 14 minutes.
Yeah, it's a pretty great show, and it's based on Ryder's actual real-life experience. It's a great story about an actor kind of coming up in New York, making things with his friends, moving out here and finding success.
Yeah. Very, very hard-earned success. Like a, you know.
Yeah, I made it sound easy.
You made it sound like it was like 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
No. A show on Netflix.
Yeah, but Ryder's really great. He's filled with insight and great anecdotes, and it was a really fun conversation.
But before we get to Ryder, I'm dying to know, Matt, what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, man. Well, I think I've been writing a ton lately, in addition to kind of the regular old shooting and directing and all that stuff. I've been writing a bunch, and I just sent a decent amount of, like a few treatments basically, off to my agent and manager, and they liked some of them.
And that's like a one-page write-up of a TV show or something?
No, some bigger stuff. So they liked one of the things pretty well, but the thing that I'd been working on kind of for a while was like, you know, probably closer to 12, 16 pages, like a pretty thorough outline of a movie that I've been working on. And they didn't really love it.
And they read the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's 12 pages. They read enough to speak to it and to say, you know, like, here are some things I liked about it, and I think that you need to rethink some things.
But was it like, you should rewrite this, or was it like, we're not really vibing with this idea, try something new from scratch?
I don't think that they would ever say, we're not vibing with this, try something new from scratch. But they did not encourage me to keep going down the path of working on this project.
Oh, right. They weren't like, oh, this is like 90% there.
Yeah, yeah. In, you know, sweet and constructive ways. And I think also, you know, you kind of always are up against this challenge of like, you know, as an artist, right? As an artiste, sometimes you're like, well, of course you don't get it. That's the point. No one's ever done this before.
Right.
And also, I'm not saying that I'm anywhere near that revolutionary, but you know, what I really mean is like sometimes agents and managers are a little more transactional.
Right? Yeah,
like, can I sell this or not?
Right? They're not known for risk taking.
Right, right. And they have what they think are my best interests in mind because they're trying to think of things that they can sell. So no harm, no foul, basically, that they didn't get it. But it did kind of coincide with a question that we got in the voicemail recently. So I thought we could kind of dovetail this all into the topic of how, not just to receive notes, but how to speak Hollywood when you dislike something, basically.
Right. It's about honesty in L.A. Let's hear that question.
Hey, Oren and Matt, this is Jeff from Olympia, Washington. So I have a question. I have a situation. I was actually in, let's just say an event, and I met a well-known director, and he commented on a show that's playing on one of the streaming services, asked me if I'd seen it and what I thought about it. And he told me the name, and I kind of laughed and said, oh, I was hated it, you know. And he completely just burst out laughing. I was like, you're not supposed to say that, you know. And I didn't know that. He initially said, you're not supposed to say that, but yeah, I agree with you. But the funny thing is the next day he was on a panel, and one of the stars of that show was also there. And all of a sudden he was just praising the hell out of this show. So there, I guess that my question is now, I don't know, it's really about honesty, I guess. What is honesty in LA? Does it exist? Or is everything that people do good? You know, is it just this constant praise that the constant adulation for anything anybody does? And then you go talk about it and pine their back. You know, I don't know exactly what that is, but is that a normal thing?
So Jeff is asking if people in LA just aren't honest.
Right. And I think that there's a couple different layers that we need to peel back on this, right? Because certainly my anecdote about my agent manager was that they were honest with me that they didn't really love the thing that I had been working on for kind of a while. But they would never outright say, I hate this or I dislike this, right? And so I think that we are in an environment where we're around people who are really busting their butts all the time to make some stuff that sometimes you really love it and you're really proud of it and it's really special. And sometimes, you know, Oren and I have both made things that like we really worked our hardest at and didn't turn out the way we wanted, right?
Yeah, I think all of them.
Yeah, to varying degrees, certainly. And you need your team to be honest with you about like, hey, I love this piece. This is something that we really need to share around and I want you to be known for it and all of that. And sometimes they need to be like, hey, maybe, you know, let's not talk about this one quite so much or not lead with this one. And also what I was saying was that like when you're surrounded by people who are making things all the time, you learn to be a little more, understanding of the work that goes into it. Right. If all of your peers and all your friends are working 14 hours a day for 9 months on something, then for someone to be like, ugh, I hated it, you know, could hurt their feelings, you know. And there are a lot of people who aren't responsible for whether or not you hate a thing or not. Right.
Right.
So that's why I think some of that language becomes coded. You know, you've got sensitive artists and then you've got a ton of craftspeople who are all working really hard. And so no one ever wants to be like, oh, that sucked, right?
Yeah. Well, I think I hate to get elementary school on it, but like there's something about constructive criticism that is like super valuable, especially when you are working in a field where people are trying to like reveal things about themselves, be vulnerable, be truthful, be honest, mm-hmm. be artistic, you know, for you to do all that. And then for someone to say they hated it is like, it's really hurtful and it's not constructive in any way.
And especially when you're surrounded by people who know what a triumph it is to even get something made in the first place, when you're empathetic to that, it becomes a lot harder to even think in those terms, you know?
Yeah. And by the way, anyone that's worked in this business for like more than a day can tell when people like their stuff or don't like their stuff. So you telling someone you hated their work or disliked it or were not into it is like, they already know that some people don't like, you know? So I think to me, like the way you approach it is like, what'd you think about this show? Like, well, you know, if you're talking to someone that has no vested interest in the show, I think it's totally fine to say like, yeah, I didn't like it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking to someone that is remotely close to the show or knows people that like, you know, if a friend of mine is dating someone that was mm-hmm. had one tiny role on a TV show that I didn't like, I would say like, oh, I love the casting, you know? Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, I really like the set. The story was like sure. a little slow for me or something.
There's a great 30 Rock episode where Jenna talks about how Tina Fey's character would always just compliment the lighting in all of her shows.
Right. By the way, I learned that from Joe McLaren. He like sent me this movie. He's like, what'd you think of the movie? And I was like, it looks amazing. The cinematography is incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like number
That's
one.
That's code for I don't like the movie.
Yeah.
Or I don't like anything but the cinematography.
Yeah, that's code for, and I learned from that experience to not, like if you comment on something very technical like that, to me, that's like the same as saying like you didn't like something.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
But I try to, I truly, it's a super subjective field, right? Mm-hmm. Like whether we're judging Pee Wee Herman or The Godfather or whatever, it's like, there's some things in everything, you can find something that you like and something that you don't like. And so like, if you're telling people, well, this is what I responded to and this is what I liked, whether it's the lighting or the style or the pacing or something, then they know, okay, you didn't like the other things and maybe I should like those or not, or address those.
Right. Exactly. So there's constructive criticism. There's kind of, you know, focusing on the positive. And then there's also the way we talk about the negative, right? So oftentimes people will use phrases and words like, I didn't connect with it, or it just wasn't for me, or I didn't spark to it, or this thing bumped for me, or I couldn't get into it? You know, those are all code words for...
I fell asleep halfway through the first
sentence. I didn't like it, right? But that's saying I didn't like it can be a hurtful thing to say. To say, oh, it wasn't for me, acknowledges that like other people might like it, but I did not.
Yeah, and that is always true.
Yeah.
I'm curious, a lot of times I've been reading scripts lately where I'm really bothered by the writing style. Like, I don't like the way they name their characters. I don't like the scene description, but it doesn't really affect the story.
It's not going to change what ends up on screen.
Right. Yeah. So how do you ever have that where you're like, oh, this is like a hard to read script, but the story's not bad.
I think that if I know that other people, well, if my name is on it,
oh, well, then if your name is on it.
Yeah, no, but I would just change it. Yeah.
But if someone else's name.
I think if you're aware that it's hard to get into it, and that like maybe it's going to make it a challenge for actors to get into it, that's a thing worth considering.
Yeah. Well, someone sent me like a script the other day, and the main characters were named like Jane and Jenna, and I was like, both with J's, and I was like,
yeah, and N's.
Yeah, I was like, I honestly spent half the script trying to figure out who was who.
Yeah, I mean, that is a rookie mistake.
Yeah, but so that's the type of feedback I've actually stopped giving people, because I don't think it's important feedback, you know, necessarily. But to me, honesty is like such a big topic. Of course, if someone says like, do you like this TV show, and I don't really like it, I'll say like, not really. It's not a big deal in LA. But
if you're at the premiere for the TV show and someone said, what do you think?
Yeah, if you're talking to anyone related to it, you say like, I just went to the Deadwood movie premiere. Mm-hmm. I do not know Deadwood. The movie I didn't quite understand what's going on. I talked to the people there that had worked on it, and I was like, I love like the way the dialogue. It's like a Shakespeare in the West. And I didn't even know that about the show, and I was like, really fascinating. That's like, so that's what I said, because that's like the thing that I most connected with it. And then I saw on Twitter other people like loved the movie. They're like, the movie does justice to the show, like a perfect ending. Like, so you never know. It's better to not make enemies. Everyone knows that. But also, it really depends on what part of the process you're talking about. Like, if you sent me a script or even a rough cut, I'd be like, oh, I didn't like this joke. Maybe you can cut this out. And you can say like, well, that's my favorite joke. I'm not cutting it, right? But yeah, if you sent me...
literally that's happened.
Yeah, but if you sent me, you're like, hey, it's the final cut, you know, it's pre-screening, I would be like, I love it.
Congrats, man. Yeah.
Yeah, like I would not...
I love the cinematography.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would not... You don't want notes on something that is not notable yet. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's like, if they say, hey, I'm going to make a sequel, or now I'm working on my next thing, and you have some opinions and you want to like help, in quotes, what you think is helping, then you can say like, hey, what if in this next one there's like more dialogue or more this, or you kind of take a stronger point of view?
I think only if someone asks for that should you ever say something like that. Like if
what if it's like your wife?
Yeah, that's different. That's different. If you have a really personal relationship with the person, then yeah, and it's in their best interest for you to correct a blind spot, sure. But like if you were just casually with someone and they're you know you're talking to the director of John Wick 4, like they don't need for me to be like, hey, you know, I think like less of the gun stuff.
Right. Yeah, they already have enough people telling them that, and then enough people telling them the exact opposite as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think in conclusion, I do think that LA has this reputation for not being honest, for being fake. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's like more about being sensitive to people and to people's like art, whether it's like total junk Sharknado or whether it's, you know, true, yeah, like high prestige cinema. There's just something nice about being sensitive to people's feelings.
Yeah. And I think that it, the closer you are to actually making the stuff, to making mass media, the more sensitive you are to that, right? Because you're just more intimately aware of what it takes to do it.
Right. Wait, let me ask you one last question actually on this topic. Like, if a friend of yours made a movie that you really didn't like, and then they asked you what you thought of the movie, would you ever say, I loved it? Or would you... Because to me, there's like the difference, like, you can be honest without lying. I don't like, you know.
Yeah, I think that...
Because maybe that is really what Jeff is asking us.
It's right.
Like, this director said he hated something, and then the next day he said he loved it.
Right. Well, on a panel, right? So there's two separate things there. If your job is to sell the movie, right? A panel is marketing. You are part of a commercial, an hour-long commercial or a live commercial where you talk about how great the movie is. And I would maybe talk around explicitly saying that I loved a certain aspect of a project that I didn't. I think that my friends know me well enough. I would say that, you know, like, it wasn't for me, right? And if they keep pushing...
I'll say, oh, it's really fun.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. Yeah, that's just us not wanting to say, hey, I hated your thing.
Right.
I think that the big exception is, like, there's a difference between not connecting with it and being offended by it. Like, if somebody made something that was racist or sexist or insensitive in a way and they didn't know it, I think I would have a harder time with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's interesting. Do you remember that movie, Million Dollar Baby?
Mm-hmm.
There's like, actually, I don't know if I've seen it all the way, but at the end, I think someone dies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a decision that's made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my uncle was quadriplegic, and my grandmother was kind of like his caretaker. And she said she loved the movie, except she hated the ending because she doesn't think like anyone would be better off dead. You know, mm-hmm. She was offended by it, but she still liked the movie. The offensiveness thing is a different thing. We've talked about that here. And again, I think I would only give that note in a place where I could be helpful with that. But if not, I would just be like, cool.
Yeah.
Good job. Yeah. You racist ass.
Bye.
Yeah. Anyhow, well, cool. Well, before we get into writers, should we tell people about our Patreon?
That's right.
Patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a way you can support the podcast if you tune into it every Thursday. If you're from Olympia, Washington, if your name is Jeff. Just kidding. No, but if you think the show is something that you like having in your life and you want to help us keep making it, then check out patreon.com/justshootitpod. And by the way, if you do a $10 pledge, even for 1 month, we're going to mail you the all-new, amazing Just Shoot It podcast hat, which I've been wearing all around town, and people have just been look at me like I'm a crazy cool cat.
Yeah, people are just honking and waving.
Yeah,
they're all so excited. So if you would like a hat, let us know. We've got a bunch of hats in our Orange garage now.
Yeah, and if you see someone walking around with a Just Shoot It podcast hat, there's a high chance it's me. Say hi.
Yeah, please.
We're taking a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Plot Devices. They make the Story Clock Notebook, and we have one of the co-founders, Seth Worley, here with us to talk to us about why you would use the Story Clock Notebook.
So the Story Clock Notebook is a tool for researching and developing stories. The first half of the book is for watching movies, writing down time codes, the story beats that happen at those times, visualizing that like a clock so that you can get a bird's eye view of the structure of that story. And the benefits of that are, one, procrastinating and not actually having to do any writing.
Sure, love it.
But also being able to internalize the structures of your favorite movies, not so that you can create like a framework of rules or systems that you have to work within going forward, but to have a reference point, be able to point to and say, I'm not doing this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jurassic Park, for example, takes the entire first half of the movie to get the boulder up the hill before the promise of the premise ever happens.
Which is what, the dinosaurs escaping?
Yeah, the T-Rex breaks out exactly at the midpoint of the movie. And if anyone going to see the movie, they went to go see dinosaurs break out and eat people. And it's not going to happen until the second half of the movie. So why does that work still? Like, why were there not executives giving notes saying to compress that and have that
happen?
Where
are the dinosaurs, baby?
Yeah.
That's how executives sound, right?
That's exactly how they sound. So we made the Story Clock Notebook to be able to do that for story nerds like me, to be able to sit down, watch a movie, and visualize its story structure, and have a central place to where you can keep all of this nerdy research of yours to be able to go back and look at later when you're working on your own stories as well.
In honor of Jurassic Park and Steven Spielberg and the fact that he can do no wrong, give or take a couple movies, We're giving away a Spielberg pennant as part of our Story Clock promotion.
For a chance to win that Spielberg pennant, all you have to do is go to Instagram or Twitter and tag @PlotDevicesCO with the name of the movie that changed your life as a filmmaker. For me, it was definitely Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. The heart ripping out, the mineshaft roller coasters, it really made me want to be in that movie. We're dying to hear what your movie was, so go to Instagram or Twitter right now and tag PlotDevicesCO with the movie that changed your life. We wanted to give a quick disclaimer before we get into this interview that if you have kids around you or are sensitive to adult topics, we do discuss some more adult things that are found in the dominatrix featuring show Bonding in this interview. If you're not sensitive to those things, you are going to love it. So here's the interview. Okay, hey. We are here with Ryder Doyle.
Ryder Doyle.
Hi. There's no like splashy intro or something. I was just sort of waiting.
We do that at the end, actually.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
We'll be like, we love how much we learned from Ryder about X, Y, and Z, like but was, we don't know
oh,
what
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No.
We thought we'd learn a lot more from Ryder Doyle.
Oh, my God.
Here's the interview.
Me too.
Just kidding. No, we're super excited to have you. We share a manager, Jacob Perlin.
Yes. Well, Jacob is not technically my manager, but he produced
oh, he's
the
not?
Show. No, my manager is Derek Gordon, who's also at Anonymous. And so I pitched this idea to her, and then she sent me to Jacob and Nina Soriano, and they came aboard. So,
oh, interesting.
Maybe they regret it now. Who knows?
Well, I guess this is like, we're diving right into it, which is like, so you made Bonding, you wrote, you directed it.
Uh-huh.
You do not star in it for some reason.
No, I don't star in it. Well, it's written for two 22-year-olds, and I know we're in a podcast and you can't see my face, but maybe in like 10 years when I get a facelift, then I'll be 22 again.
But also if you watch Barry, you can see you.
Yes, you can see me being...
You're the one that's throwing up in the toilet, right?
I'm the one that's throwing up in the toilet. I like to say I'm the gay guy in the acting class, though it's never really explicit, but we kind of like tick out those boxes for the acting class, those sort of stereotypes of who might be in an acting class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. With a little, with an eating disorder. Spoiler alert.
Sure.
But you have an eating disorder?
Yeah, that's kind of like the... You don't really see... I mean, like they cut...
Oh, that's what
yeah,
you're...
Yeah, that's why I'm throwing up in a toilet. Yeah. Barry is an amazing show to work on because we actually film so much. And I think one of the reasons that the show works so well is that they really let us fly, the acting class and the mob, you know, those two sides of the show. And then they pack it all into 30 minutes. And you've never seen so many things happen in 30 minutes before. They're just running through story. They're running through jokes. They're running through character super quickly. So one of the great things about the show is that it's so playful and fun. And one of the hits to one's ego is how much of everything gets cut out of the show.
Sure. Oh, that you had so many. I mean, I think the, you know, each character is doing like basically a short one act, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I'm sure there's a ton of great material left on the floor.
Yeah, well, that whole conceit this year of them doing a story about the acting class doing stories about their lives actually comes from after season one, Bill asked Sarah Goldberg and I, because we both come from theater backgrounds, if we had ever done anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And she's the one, she's the main, the female lead.
Yeah, she's the main female lead. And I had worked at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and actually I was, here we go, diving in, but I was bulimic in my early 20s, and I told this story about how at Williamstown, I told that story to a playwright and a director, and they made a show about that. So I played like essentially my bulimic self in my 20s in this large show about like self-help. And so that's a part of where this season's conceit comes from, which is so speaks so highly of Bill and Alec that they are always looking for input and ideas from the people that they work with.
Right. So they were desperate for ideas.
Yeah.
They're like, Ryder, they're like,
I don't know. Let's Ryder, what do you think?
Yeah. You know, what's also great is that because neither of them come from a theater background or, you know, Bill comes from an improv background, but never went to real acting class, that they heavily rely on, our quote unquote expertise on what that experience is like. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's super fun.
So did you study theater in college?
Yeah, I studied theater in college. I went to Bard College in upstate New York. I went there and I studied theater. It was not necessarily acting school. It's more of like the, you know, intellectual esoteric ideas.
Kind of like
theater.
Pretentiousness school?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, everyone was from New York and LA and much cooler than me. I grew up in New Orleans. which is a very cool place to be from, obviously, but maybe not in the artsy-fartsy way that kids from LA and New York are. So,
You did voodoo and stuff, right, growing
yeah,
up?
Yeah, I did. I did voodoo and alcohol, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's the family lineage there.
Perfect.
So then tell us about bonding. Like, I guess, where did that come from?
Okay, so bonding is based on my real-life experience of becoming a dominatrix assistant / bodyguard for one of my best friends when I first moved to New York. I was working like four jobs. I was working concessions at the New York Theater Workshop, and, you know, I was assisting a gardener, you know, doing whatever I could, and taking acting classes.
Assisting a gardener?
Like, yeah, well, I mean, like, it's darker than it sounds. He has HIV AIDS and couldn't lift, got sick enough. He was a wonderful gardener and he couldn't, got sick and couldn't lift his own soil. So essentially I would like pack the soil for him. So you tried to make a joke and then I fucking ruined you.
Wow, you went deep.
I know. Eventually my friend sort of confessed to me that this is what she was doing with her life. And if I needed extra money, I could do it as well.
This being dominatrixing.
Yeah.
Or do you call it dominating?
Doming.
Oh, doming.
You know, BDSM doming. Yeah. So I did that. I did it very briefly, if I'm being honest. And, but it was a very formative and funny and strange experience for me. It sort of became this like running party story, you know, like an epic 30-minute party story. I told it at my friend's baby shower once because they're like, tell that story.
Yeah. It's your A material.
Yeah. Exactly. And eventually I thought, yeah, I should do something with this. And with a lot of time, and in retrospect, I saw just how formative actually that experience was for me in opening me up sexually, because I had just come out of the closet and I was a pretty fearful young gay at the time, no longer, but that was the idea. And then it sort of just became a bigger story. It's highly fictionalized. Most of the things that happened on the show, did not happen to me specifically.
In real life, there's a lot more peeing.
I pee every day, multiple times a day, but you know, in the gay community, like peeing on people is like not such a big deal. That's not something I would learn for years. I mean, it's not my bag particularly, but, you know, it's,
I was not aware of that.
At first blush, you're like, oh my God. And then everyone's like, yeah, I peed on him. You're like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
And now you're getting married.
Yeah. Cool. Congratulations.
This is an educational podcast.
Yeah.
So then you got to LA at some point, right?
Yeah. So I was working in New York as an actor. I did some movies and TV shows. And
did you do theater too?
Yeah, I did. I did one Broadway show called Enron, which was about the rise and fall of the Enron Corporation. And it ran for 2 weeks. It was a huge hit in London and a severe bomb in America. No one wanted to pay like $200 to, you know,
get depressed.
Like, think about how they don't have any money.
Were you like a CEO or like an exec?
I played one of the Lehman brothers. We were conjoined twins. And then,
are you serious?
For real. It was very theatrical, actually, but written by a wonderful writer named Lucy Prebble, who now writes on, what's that HBO show about the family?
Succession.
Succession, yes. And has written movies and plays, and she's incredible. And it was directed by Rupert Gould, who directed the movie True Story. Yeah.
I have a genuine practical question, actually, about the assistant doming gig.
Yeah.
How lucrative was it?
It pays really, really well.
Really well.
I mean, I was getting a small cut of what that was, and you know, walking away with much more money than I was making anywhere
else.
And
your friend was a woman?
Yes. Yeah. And so it is. I mean, like, it does, you know, people, the
especially
stereotype,
New York, right?
Like, yeah, Manhattan. The stereotype is that it's a bunch of big, like, finance guys. I mean, like, we would literally go to, like, mansions in White Plains to, like, also, like, there was barely any furniture in them, you know, just like, like, I remember one of them had, like, huge, like, Maine Coon cat in a cage. I mean, like, it's just these guys who are, like, you know, really fucking, you know, can't stop talking about how big their dick is, and then, you know, they want to, in private, be paid to talk about how small their dick is, you know.
Right, so that is from a true...
That is true, yeah.
So why did you move to L.A.?
Oh, so I moved to L.A. because I had written my first... After Enron was a bomb, one of my best friends, Zoe Kazan, who's a wonderful actress and writer, we shared the same agent at the time, and I had been writing, and I showed her my writing, and she said, you should show this to our agent. That show was called The Walker, and it was about a gay guy with a bunch of best girlfriends who becomes a gay best friend for hire. So essentially, mm-hmm. like a theme running through my work is monetizing emotion. Mm-hmm. And so...
Can I ask you for a second? Yeah. Did you start writing because you were like really kind of felt the... urge to write, or were you like, I want to make some of my own material, so I'm going to like hunker down, lock myself in my apartment and write?
Yeah, well, I think coming into this world as an actor, you know, you sort of think like, what are the avenues and channels that could work for me? And in sort of in this, you know, Lena Dunham-esque age that we were all sort of walking into in those, in that last decade, it was like, well, how can I write my own material to mm-hmm. make something that people can see me in? Because, you know, I was playing like the gay babysitter in Young Adult, or mm-hmm. the gay mm-hmm. whatever on Law and Order SVU. And, you know, you just sort of like, okay, this is going to be my lot in life. And if I have, you know, any semblance of talent, maybe I can try and do something else. But honestly, what really got me writing was most every script I would read, no matter what part I was going in for, was pretty bad.
Sure.
And I thought, like, if people are getting paid to do bad things, like, I could get paid to do a bad thing. Like, I think
you mean if the writers are getting paid to.
Like, or if people are getting, you know, if you're seeing a bad movie or the, you know, whatever. I just thought like, well, I can do bad shit. Like, I mean, like, are people getting paid to do that? So I think it sort of came from this loss of fear mm-hmm. that I could make something and it would be bad. I thought, well, I just have to try every avenue because I'm not really paying my rent.
Right. That's what I love about film festivals. That you go to like Sundance and you go to the shorts program and you're like, that wasn't that good. I can make something better as like equally bad to that.
Yeah. And it's actually like wonderfully inspiring in a weird way where you're like, I mean, just, you know, taking the risk of doing anything, could be rewarding. You know, mm-hmm. It's like getting on the roller coaster. It's like, it looks really scary. Turns out it's really fun. You may have thrown up on yourself, but you probably will do it again, you know.
Sure. I'm asking you all these things. You know, our podcast is primarily about directing and filmmaking, but something that we think about all the time and that our guests talk about all the time is like writing, because no one's giving you a great script. You
creating, know? Just shooting it as part of that is generating your own
content. Right, yeah.
So as a director, but as an actor, you're saying it's pretty much the exact same thing.
Yeah, you're coming into it. I mean, that is the groundwork. It's the foundation of everything you're going to do. And I think, you know, film, TV and film in particular, actually, is very director-centric medium, because you take a script and then you bring it to life in from the point of view, mm-hmm. your aesthetic point of view, all these different things. I think in the theater, the genesis and the art of theater primarily comes from a playwright. So looking at both ends of that, I thought, like, you know, what's most important for me as an actor is given the opportunity to tell stories that I think are important and valuable. I was not given that as an actor, so I thought maybe as a writer I could give that to myself or give that to other people. And I found out through my first process of writing for myself that I was not that interested in myself, though I was interested in some of the things that I'd been through in my life. So coming into bonding, I wanted to write about an experience of my life that was bigger than me, mm-hmm. and that I was not going to cast, you know, some version of me. I wanted to step very far outside of myself.
Yeah.
When you say you weren't interested in yourself, you mean...
I'm very interested in myself. I'm like self-obsessed.
You mean obviously. Like in subject matter?
I just not interested in, like, I think that the first thing I wrote was coming from the place of being like, I'm going to write something for myself that will showcase me and will showcase who
as
I
an actor.
Am. And yeah. And then I thought, like...
So actually, there's like an action scene. There's a scene where you cry.
Yeah.
Like, kind of like all, that type, where you do a funny
like,
accent.
I'm funny and yeah. And but then I think I learned through that experience that was storytelling was much more important to me than telling my own stories or stories that would be
like vehicles for you as an actor.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think writing can be something where it's inspired by your true life experience. Of course, it kind of almost always has to be, but extrapolating beyond that, taking those emotional experiences and then kind of seeing it through the lens of other characters. Is really
It's like Spielberg is like, you know, every movie is, you know, the parents are gone and sure. the kid is on their own, and you know, it has this sort of, but it's all steeped in his own mythology of himself, you know, right. And when you're watching these movies, you're like, oh yeah, like I know who this person is and what he wants to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so I thought maybe I'd step more into a Spielbergian direction. I don't know.
Well, so when did you start directing?
Oh yeah. So I took this project out and, you know, it obviously
you're talking about
has
bonding.
It's obviously,
and is this the first project you've kind of taken around to pitch?
Yeah. Well, so the Walker was, brought out by a company, the Littlefield Company. Warren Littlefield used to run NBC and now has a big production company. They do Handmaid's Tale, Fargo, all those things.
Never heard of them. Is right. this, when you were in LA already?
No, I was in New York and we had made a short version of the show with like mm-hmm. all of my like best girlfriends in New York City.
And did you play the main character?
I played the main character and it was, Zoe Kazan and Betty Gilpin and Carrie Mulligan and Lily
Solid
was
friends
in it,
to have,
Gabby
yeah.
Sidibe and all of these, you know, Aya Cash, all these incredible oh, wow. actors. But they all of us started in New York or met doing theater before they had gotten famous. So this was sort of a journey for all of us. If mm-hmm. anything, it was like a nice little time capsule of what it was like to be 27 in New York City with all of our friends. And it was brought out to L.A. The Littlefield Company loved the show. We developed the show.
I'm going to just slow you down for a second. So you just shot like a short, like a proof of concept.
Yeah, well, we shot the whole, I think the episodes are maybe 7 minutes. They're super short, but it was like, it was a web series, but just with like some very flashy people involved in it.
And were they flashy at the time?
They were, I mean, Carrie had been nominated for an Academy Award, but, and so had Gabby Sidibe and, you know, Zoe and, I would say that the least flashy person at that moment was Betty, who is essentially, as all my girlfriends well know now, is just the muse of my life. She's the funniest, most interesting, like weirdest actress I've ever seen.
Right. And our listeners would know her from Glow, probably.
Yes. Yes. From Glow.
Most prominently.
Yeah. yeah.
So who paid for that?
A guy named Andrew Corkin Productions, Corked Productions. I sort of forget the name of the production company, but lovely guy. We made it super, super quickly. And his, this guy, Brian Riceberg, one of his best friends who's director, he directed it. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very quick.
And so it's like a web series. You shot a few episodes in New York.
Yeah, we shot a few episodes in New York and then screened it out in LA and we had some bites.
Was it on spec or like was there a buyer? You said there were bites, so you're selling it around.
But so you're selling it around, but sort of to repurpose it as a television show. You know?
Yeah, sorry. I'm going to rewind one more time just because I think just to give you like some insight into our audience, it's like always about kind of like the way in. And
sorry,
like the
I'm going thing. Too fast.
No, it's like, but this is the interesting thing. Like how did you, so you're friends with all these great actresses, right? And how did you get whoever financed it on board to
send them a script? So through our mutual agent at the time, Jen Conowall, who's now a manager and producer at Washington Square, amazing, amazing person. She showed it to Andrew Corkin, she had some sort of business ties with.
Just showed him the script.
Yeah, showed him the script. And he loved the script. And I had written it for all of my friends. So they were essentially naturally attached to the show. And that was enough for him to go ahead and give us the money. I mean, it was not a lot of money.
Did you write the whole season?
Yeah. I wrote it very quickly.
How many episodes did you write?
I think it's 8. I'm actually not sure. I haven't watched it in a very long time, if I'm being
honest.
How long
ago was this?
This is, I was 27, so 9 years ago.
Okay. And so I'm trying to think what was, that was like probably the Adam Film Super Deluxe days or no?
Give or take. Yeah. There were in the digital landscape, there were buyers out there. Like people were turning web series into TV shows.
Right.
So it's
yes.
a kind of a backdoor
like drunk
pilot,
history basically. Probably around.
Right. So yeah, this was all happening in and around that time. It was like it was like the Wild Wild West. I mean, I think it still is in many ways, but
like, were you thinking like, ooh, web series is like what everyone's doing. I should do one.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it follows, and I'm jumping forward and then I'll come back, but it follows a similar trajectory of what happened with Bonding, and which is that I had very limited expectations of what we were doing. I really wanted to make something. If anything, I wanted to make a really good reel for mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. Me as a writer and me as an actor. And it seemed to grow and grow and grow in ways that I had not expected at all. So for anyone out there who's looking to make something, lowered expectations.
And did you write it like with locations you knew in mind? Like, how did you kind
of... Yeah, sort of. My boyfriend at the time, now ex-boyfriend, is he worked at a restaurant that I knew we could get for free. Mm-hmm. I knew we could film in my apartment building, though they eventually kicked us out. Sure. You know, so it was very location oriented in that way. We were filming in the spring in New York City, so we were stealing a bunch of shots mm-hmm. and doing that kind of stuff. So it was pretty guerrilla, especially for the other people that were working on the right. show, who would really only do that for a friend.
Sure.
You're talking about the actors.
Yeah, the actors.
But it was also, I'm sure, super fun.
Yeah, right? No, we had such a wonderful time. Right. If anything, I think that the show, eventually what happened was is that it wasn't picked up by, we were at Sony with the show, and it wasn't picked up by any network.
Was it Crackle?
No, like to become a television show. Oh, we okay. were, and but so it gestated, mm-hmm. this version of it gestated for years and years, maybe I guess two and a half years. Sony and the Littlefield Company let it go. And a girl I had met early on in the process named Christine D'Souza, now Christine D'Souza Gelb, she was a buyer with like a small company mm-hmm. That was looking to sell the web version of the show. She had since moved to WME. And she called me and she said, we're friends. And she called me and she said, listen, I know that the show is now up for grabs. Refinery 29 is looking to buy content. And it was the first thing they bought. And since it was already made, it was mm-hmm. the first thing that went up on their site for them. So it went to Refinery 29. And then I went to WME with Christine.
So that brought you to LA.
So that brought me to LA. And then I was, but it was an exhausting process. And honestly, mm-hmm. like as an actor, it sort of put me in a weird position where I was not sure how to juggle all of these things that I had started doing. So everything that I had wanted had come to fruition. I was now with a great agency mm-hmm. with great management.
And they repped you like for writing and directing?
Yeah, for everything. And, but I was...
I mean, and acting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I just got kind of, I guess, scared a little bit. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do next. And I was going to auditions and I really wasn't succeeding at them. And I kind of had a year and a half of really nothing. Mm-hmm. And I wrote I'm obsessed with The Real Housewives. And I wrote a spec finale for The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, where essentially...
The reality show.
Yeah, the reality show with like no talking heads. Essentially mm-hmm. just becomes like a film, you know, like a 60-minute sure. film. What happened was is that like one of the dogs of one of The Real Housewives is having a birthday party, and she gets all of these stuffed animals as gifts for everyone else. And it looks just like her dog, but her mm-hmm. dog doesn't really move. It's a very old dog. And she drops the dog into all of these stuffed animals mm-hmm. and she can't find her dog, mm-hmm. the thing that she loves the most in the world. So she's like looking in the eyes of all these stuffed animals, thinking if it's her real dog.
Sure, sure.
Meanwhile,
searching
all the
for meaning.
Other, yeah. yes, exactly. Yeah. And all the other housewives are coming to this party to kidnap or kill the dog because they are jealous of this woman. So it kind of goes crazy. Everyone gets killed. There's like really creepy dog voiceover that comes in at the end. And I wrote this thing just because I wanted to. And mm-hmm. My agents were asking me to write a spec. And I was like, I had this funny idea about a spec yeah. about how the friends get caught up in the Ebola crisis or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they get quarantined into their apartment. You know, it was all these kind of like weird ideas that I was having. And I would, you know, show it to people and they'd be like, this is really funny, but like, we don't really know what to do with this.
Yeah. Which normally you're like, well, you're an agent, figure out how to sell it. Well, in this case, you have to cut them a little bit more slack, right?
But it's a writing sample.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just a writing sample. And I think that what it saw for what was good about all of it for me is that I felt creatively fulfilled because I felt like I had made something mm. that I thought was good for the first time maybe ever. And it had no attachment to being made. And I didn't care if it got made. I didn't care if anyone was interested in it. And it sort of like woke this thing up in me, which was like, when we made The Walker, I didn't direct it. I didn't fight anyone on it. I didn't have sort of
a
clear artistic vision, even as a writer, of what I was making. I was like, here's an idea. Here's how I'm going to do this idea. It just has to get made. And then from this sort of sadness or sort of weird depression that came out of nothing coming from it, I just started making things that I was really proud of that no one would ever see. Yeah. And that's sort of where this next step in my career came.
You started working on Writer.
Yeah, I started working on Writer, the person, the whatever. Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit about then the genesis of bonding, right? So obviously you've got this real world experience, right? Mm-hmm. And all of that.
And by the way, I just want to pause and say, I watched the whole thing and I love it. And I got a haircut yesterday and I was asking the guy that was cutting my hair. I was like, so did you watch Game of Thrones? Did you watch the finale? He's like, I'm not really into it. I was like, well, what do you watch? He's like, well, I'm really loving this show Bonding. And the woman at the haircut at the station next, she's like, I know, it's so good, right?
Oh my God. So, that's so nice to hear.
Yeah. And I was like,
if only they were better at cutting hair, though.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I don't know if you're noticing my
podcast. My mom. Missing out. So bonding, I'm sure, you know, everyone's always saying, like, write what you know. Like, what are your great, you know, mm-hmm. experiences? And obviously, you've been, you know, doing this material at cocktail parties for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So you have that aha moment of, like, oh, this is my next series. Tell us about how that all came to be.
Well, so I was pitching at post me writing a bunch of these other weird things that sort of didn't go anywhere, but that I was super proud of. I was with Dara, my manager in New York. She was like, let's go over some new ideas. You know, like what's on the horizon.
Can I ask you at this point, are you kind of stressed out? Cause you've had your manager, you're with William Morris, you're with Anonymous at the point at the time. Like the great reps,
and
like nothing has really happened for a while, except for you wrote one script that you're really proud of.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever get stressed that like your reps are like,
there's that flip where you're like, if only I had incredible people,
right?
Be out
right.
there.
And you're then like, all of a sudden, I'm not the incredible person. Yeah.
Like, sometimes I'm like, I wish I made more money for Jacob.
Yes.
So
oh my God.
He would be more excited to pitch me.
I make, the least amount of money for Dara Gordon than anyone's ever made her. She has very starry clients. But I got nervous about that kind of stuff, but I also knew that people were invested in me in the long run. And I thought they saw the potential in me sometimes that I did not see in myself. So strangely, I know people have a lot of issues with their agents and their managers, but those were the people that were shepherding me into making any kind of work. I think because they thought I could do something good and I was unsure of that.
So they were just like, write something, anything.
Yeah, write something, anything. Finish something. I think it's so different. I mean, like what I tell everyone when they ask me, like, how do you do? Just shoot it. Just finish it. Just if you're going to write something, just finish it and give it to someone. Show it to them. It's not going to be perfect, but it's a jumping off point.
You think it's bad halfway through no matter what.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I still think some things are bad. I mean, like, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. I guess like a part of it is that one gets so worried about a public perception of who they are and the work that they make, when in actuality, if you get so worried about that, you'll just never make anything that the public sees. Mm-hmm. So if people think it's bad, you know, there's nothing I can say other than I did it.
Yeah. I keep thinking, sorry to bring things back to Game of Thrones, but I keep thinking about that. You know, so many people are really disappointed with the finale of the entire show. And I was equally, I think, disappointed, but I'm also like, they still made Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
These people, like, it's still the best show, like one of the best shows of all time. Like,
right.
And so people are always going to be disappointed with part of what you do, even if you make the best thing ever.
Even if they made the best finale of that show, there would still be people who are disappointed, you know, and the emotions that are elicited by the public based on the finale of Game of Thrones are only because their expectations for how good it has been have gone that way. I mean, when we made the first season of Barry, the New York Times wrote an article about how good the first season of Barry was and that they should not make a second season. They should stop right there. Yeah. And so,
because there's so many bad second seasons.
Right.
Yeah, Barry is not one.
Right. They're like, a perfect season. Leave it at that. 100 on Rotten Tomatoes. We're done.
Yeah.
And then I personally believe that they went ahead and made a better
season. Second. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty great. Well, I want to talk real quickly about, so you've got Bonding. You decide to make it, right? And it starts as a digital series, right?
Yeah.
And off mic, we were kind of talking about the way that you kind of set your own expectations.
Right. Right.
So you've already kind of made some things that didn't end up going,
right?
You get to show around and all of that. And then, you know, you make Bonding, and it's got kind of some humble beginnings, right? So tell us about the process of it ending up on Netflix ultimately.
Right.
Yeah. Or like, why even start as a web show as opposed to a TV show?
Right. So I went to Anonymous, to Jacob and Nina, and I pitched them this show, and I had written a very loose sort of treatment that was like, you know, in this day and age, in this space, there was like a 1 minute version of the show, a 15 minute version of the show, a 30 minute version of the show. Like, I was willing
micro
to,
series.
Yeah,
mid-series.
Exactly. Like,
and was there anyone partnering with you? Like, was Dara helping you with the pitch before you pitched it to Nina and Jacob? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, she always reads everything I do. We talk about everything we do. She's like, so, she's, her husband is a writer. She's like such an incredible reader of scripts and can talk about things in both the micro and the macro. And so she's been an unbelievable gift to me, as a creator, because she's an incredibly creative person. And I think that Jacob and Nina are also fall under that. So I got supremely lucky that I ended up with management side, management people who are actually extremely creative and understanding of the creative process. But I ended up, the reason I wanted to make Bonding, in telling the story, obviously furthering my career and making something, but I wanted to direct it. I looked back on The Walker and I said, I can do this, and I've worked enough as an actor, as a writer, as a creative person, that I know I can do it. And I'd never done it before.
And is it like when you're on the set of Barry or any of the other millions of movies and TV shows you've done, is that something you were paying attention to? Like, what kind of lens is using? How's the lighting? And what's
blocking? I mean, I think that that for me was something that I was trying very hard to, and luckily on Barry and on other things I've been on, they allow you that space. Mm-hmm. Many times film sets don't really do that.
What do you mean? Like the director?
Yeah. Like they look, you're allowed to be at the monitor. You're allowed to hear about the way that they're talking about the shot, what they're thinking about for the shot. Sometimes it's just sort of stand there, say it, you know, like you ask how they're framing you and you don't even know why, you know, you just want to make sure that your hands stay in or stay out, whatever you need. But yeah, I was super interested in that. A lot of my friends are filmmakers. The everyone calls them the Catfish Boys, but they're really Supermarché, Henry Joost and Rel Shulman, have been two of my best friends since I moved to New York. And,
They're the ones that did the Catfish movie and the MTV show.
Yeah.
And Zoe Kazan, she,
Zoe Kazan and Paul
did
Dano.
She direct, did they direct,
Paul directed Wildlife,
okay.
Her partner, but they wrote that together. And the movie she made, Ruby Sparks, was directed by...
The couple, John and Val.
John and Val, yeah. But I have a bunch of director friends, a bunch of people who work in the field. And you know, I just thought it was something I could do. And honestly, I don't think I can do much. So for me to have that feeling like burning inside of me, I thought I gotta test the waters here. So I went into them saying, however we make this, however we do this, I am directing it. And if that doesn't come to fruition, if everyone says no, I'm not gonna do it.
And what about, did you ever say like, can I just do the pilot?
No. So what happened was is that we'd eventually, so we pitched it at Anonymous used to have a deal with Paramount and for TV. I don't think they do anymore, but they're somewhere else. But the so we pitched it there as a television show, and almost every place that we went to, whether it be like a Super Deluxe, whether it be Paramount, any version of this show, said it's too racy or it's not racy enough. Like we want it to be like very, very sexy, take everyone's clothes off, that kind of, and I was not interested in making that show. And then there was another version of it where it was like, let's do this show, but can she actually be an accountant, you know, or something?
Sure. Yeah.
So nothing really was fitting, jiving. And then we met with this company called Black Pills, which is a French company who had just made an office in Los Angeles. And they
and
were...
How long ago was this? Like a year ago?
This is... So 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You had a Black Pills show.
Yeah, this is probably right around the same time I was making my show Townies.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They like everyone's great looking. They smoke a ton. And they've got an office in Venice, basically.
Yeah. They had a very chic office in Venice. And it was, you know, they were truly nonplussed. I mean, by like, they were excited by the idea, but the French were like, oh, like, she's a dominatrix? Okay, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's do it. So they were so, like, seemingly game. And because I was doing Barry, I was on a clock. Mm-hmm. So we had to go back and do a second season of the show.
But like, you shoot in LA, right?
We shoot in LA. So they're like, if we're going to make it, we have to make it very quickly.
Oh, because bonding takes place in New York?
In New York, yeah.
Or did that matter to you?
It mattered. Yeah, it mattered. In the first season, especially if we end up making more, I think that we'll probably shoot on more stages if we, because we'll have more money and more time. Yeah, so we were just going to go and film. I mean, we really filmed it like an indie movie. You know, we just shot the whole thing as location to location, location. So we didn't shoot episode to episode.
So you told them how many episodes, who decided on the format, you or Black Pills?
Yeah, it was a joint thing. They were making sort of, I don't know, how long was yours?
It would range from like 8 to 14 minutes, depending. Right. Yeah.
So what I loved about the Black Pills space is that they had no real clock. Mm-hmm. Like, even some of these spaces that you walk into and they're like, it's the internet, you can do whatever. They're like, but make it 12 minutes or under. Or even now, I think it's that push to content that's like 7 minutes or below, like as quick as it takes you to watch a porn. Content.
Yeah, right. 6 seconds.
Yeah, 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 exactly. that's how long it takes you to watch a porn.
Yeah, when I pitched them too, and they were like, okay, when can it be ready? Can you finish it in 3 months?
Right.
Like, that's the only thing that they seem to care about is like, how fast can we get?
Right. Yeah. I think they were very interested in just making the content. So I started writing it. I wrote it very quickly. I wrote about 400 pages in 2 months that were whittled, you know, 400, mm-hmm. you know, 100 of those pages were good.
Sure.
But I was writing and rewriting.
That's all you need though, right?
Yeah.
But exactly. Just by yourself.
By myself. Yeah.
And do you have like someone that's like reading your stuff while do you already have the deal with Black Pills now?
So we got the deal with Black Pills. So this is to the directing point, is that Black Pills came back to us and said he can direct the first three. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, offers off the table, we'll move on. And you know, everyone's like, writer.
Did you have anything in the wings, like other offers or other places you wanted to pitch?
No. But I just said, this is what I was going to do. And this is what I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And I have this great team of people around me who can work a deal for me mm-hmm. in a way that I could never work a deal for myself. So honestly, it was just naivete, blind faith, and a whole lot of ego.
And it's also cheaper to shoot, have one director.
Of course, of course, of course. And thank God that we did it this way. But they didn't fight it.
Yeah, you're block shooting. Like, what are you supposed to do? Just, like, tag out?
Right.
Well, and have five people on set every day for, you know, your comedy club or whatever? Forget about it.
I don't feel like they really understood particularly what this experience would be like. Mm-hmm. A lot of times with production companies, and they're a young production company, and they gave us the ability to do this, and I'm so grateful for that. But you know, there's a trust level that is, you know, for newer directors, for newer writers, for anything, you know, they just want to kind of give themselves some padding, some sort of security mm-hmm. there. And you know, that's one of the unfortunate things, the catch-22s of working in this profession, is that no one will give you a chance because you haven't had a chance. Mm-hmm. And so they were the people who gave me that chance.
So they said, okay, then.
Yeah, we'll do it.
All episodes.
New York, I want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
So then.
So you didn't need fog machines. It was just all Frenchmen.
Yes.
Smoking.
Yes.
So then tell us how the Netflix of it all occurred.
Right. So we went and filmed the show in New York. We did casting in New York. And
who's your cast member? I don't know them, but they're awesome.
They're so great. Yeah.
Incredible. Brennan Scannell and Zoe Levin play the two leads, and they are both Los Angeles actors. Brennan's a Los Angeles comedian and actor, and actually multiple people, when I was talking to them about the show, my friend Leslie Hedlund, who did Russian Doll, she had directed a bunch of Heathers, which Brendan played one of the Heathers in the Heathers reboot. And she was like, I know the kid. This is the only person. And I was like, okay, Leslie. You know, I was like, we have a casting director, please. And And she was absolutely right that he sent in a tape. And within a minute, I was like, stop the auditions. I mean, this is the only person for the job.
And is it like, is there, this is a SAG New Media contract? Is
that how it works? Yeah, we were under some weirdo contract for sure. I mean, no one got paid.
Right. Especially you.
Woo! Never been more successful.
Was that
never
hard?
Been more poor.
Yeah. Like to get great actors?
Well, luckily, I think people really loved the script and people loved the idea and they loved the script. And I was floored by the way that people responded to the work. And this girl, Zoe Levin, she was the last person we saw for TIFF. She sent in a tape, Dara Gordon's idea, because she's also at Anonymous. She sent in a tape the day before we had to make any decisions. And I put a minute into the tape, I put my head into my sweater and cried. Truly.
Which sure. scene did she do?
She did a couple of them. We had her do one Dom one and then one that was completely rewritten. It was not. It's a scene from The Date. But she was just all the things. It's a difficult part. Someone who's like completely closed off and right. yet is like
vulnerable.
Very yeah. vulnerable.
You have to see all of the colors.
Right. Basically. And like sort of and like her friendship with her friend like brings out this whole other part of her that no one really gets to see. And they were incredible. They didn't meet until the third day of filming because Brandon was on another project. And their first scene together was that scene in the stairwell where he has a black eye and they're talking about him going on a date. And honestly, everyone held their breath for an hour. You know, sure. and we set up that shot and we watched the two of them and it was just like magic.
Awesome. And where do we know her from?
She was, she's been in a bunch of, cool indies, The Way, Way Back, Palo Alto. Oh, yeah. But she was also in, she was on this show called The Red Band Society and she was one of the leads on that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, she's so, I mean, she seems very experienced as an actress.
She's like
from your show.
A movie star. Mm-hmm. I just like, I'm floored by her. Honestly, my one thing is after we watched her tape, I said, is she too pretty?
Mm-hmm. She's very pretty.
Sure.
She's the prettiest girl in the world.
And no one ever had a problem with that ever again.
No, but you know, it's like one of those things where you think that, you know, that was not, there was no character descriptions for anyone, especially for casting. I find personally that reading a character description that has the words beautiful in it or it beats actors down, you know, like it's essentially says like your self-worth is now valued in this way. Like your acting ability is valued in this way. So that I wasn't looking for the people that we found. We just
but did you write
them.
Anything in the casting description? Like their history or?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote like, we wrote some like history stuff, like who they were, but they were very, very baseline because I don't find it. I don't find it helpful as an actor. And I also think that they're truly embarrassing, those like sort of character descriptions. Sure. And they go out to the public. And so I was like, there will be no race. There will be no talking about people's beauty, their physical appearance, who they are. This is just about their internal life and who they are as a person.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Wow. That's a good takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, they do, but by the way, warning, they really do go out to the public. Like people will see this and like, especially like, you know, you will be judged on the way that you talked about who an actor should be or a character should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So Netflix.
Oh yeah. So we made the show and we made it for 20 days for a little under $1 million in New York. And it was like a truly, truly stretched budget. Obviously, I'm highly aesthetic and I was very, very particular about that
stuff. Can you talk about your inspiration on the visuals a little bit?
Almodovar is a huge inspiration to me.
Oh, so cool.
That was sort of a big part of that thing.
Like, I love the close-ups in the classroom and stuff, like kind of this low-angle
right,
shot.
Yeah. And everything is, you know, very shallow depth and, you know, just sort of really painting very beautiful pictures.
But wide lenses still, right?
Yeah. We wanted to create a Nate Hertzellers, who is the DP, who's unbelievably amazing and saved my ass through the entire thing. We had multiple conversations about just the beauty of the show, wanting to lift it out of the space of like a normal reality. So essentially like popping the colors, popping everything up into this sort of like wide lens, shallow depth, painting a picture of like essentially an intimate world that's got a large world around it that they can't see. Sort of these myopically focused people.
That's awesome.
Yeah, love it.
Okay, so Netflix, what happened was is that we made the show. I edited the show. It was 8 episodes. I came back to LA, edited it with our editor, Patrick Lawrence. We realized that the first 3 episodes were not working, and we cut an episode. We re-jiggered a lot of the show. Luckily, they wear the same coat throughout the whole show, so we could cheat a lot of that and sort of remade it into a 7-episode show. And then we sent the show to Cannes series. It was the first year of their TV version of Cannes. And we got in. So the first time I ever watched it with an audience was with a bunch of like French teenagers, essentially.
Yeah. Turns out the French love your work.
They love it. They loved it. And it was so thrilling. I mean, walking up the steps of the Palais, like with this rinky dink thing that I mean, truly beyond my wildest dreams. And when we came back from that, we did a couple of other festivals, and a lot of networks came a calling. WME, started getting a lot of, you know, an influx of calls of, can we see it? And so I went and had a bunch of meetings with a lot of different networks, most of which were about how do we add 15 minutes to every episode, or how do we reshape this show for, you know, our audience? And Netflix called and said, we want them to come in and pitch a season 2. And I was like,
this is before they bought season 1.
Yeah. They said, in order to buy season 1, we want to talk to them about season 1, but we need to know that there's gas in the tank. So I went in and I pitched them a season 2, and Cole Galvin, our executive over there, essentially read me like a college thesis love letter on all the things in the show that I see that no one else really sees, you know, like the color and the cinematic references and all the things that, you know, that I poured my heart and soul into that I didn't really think that.
What a gift.
Yeah.
Right? To, just to incredible. Explain, like, someone's like, hey, I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. In these terms, it's so wonderful. Right.
Yeah. I mean, Jacob Perlin said to me, he was like, I've never seen you at a loss for words. I had tears in my eyes. And I was at a pitch meeting, you know, where normally you're like, batten the hatches, you know, like you're just trying to get through this experience.
Yeah.
Tap dancing everywhere. But it was incredible. And we left the meeting, and we knew that they were going to buy the show. But we got a call, I guess, a week and a half later that they were.
And it's doing incredibly well.
Yeah, it's doing incredibly well. Nothing can prepare you for the way that, for the scope of a Netflix audience. Mm-hmm. And certainly I had lowered expectations. I just thought, you know, if it's a good reel for me, if it's on Black Pills and the right people see it, then I will keep, you know, I can keep making this work. I can keep,
you can make your own private links and send it to people if you need to.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, that someone can do it. I don't know if I can even figure out how to do that, but someone can do it. And, so that was every step of the way for me was just trying to get the most, to squeeze the most juice out of, you know, this over squeezed orange, and to have it then go to Netflix, which where they were like, oh baby, we got pulp in stock. Like, this is like, we're going to throw this at everybody. It's done incredibly well. And it's been so thrilling and honestly terrifying.
Sure. Yeah. That's fascinating too. Right. Like now, I mean, it's easy to pitch in a hypothetical, but then all of a sudden, like, you're following this up.
Yeah, and then, you know, like little things that you're like, oh, that's a little mistake I made, or this I would have maybe done differently, are just sort of like...
You rushed post, you rushed everything,
right? Yeah, they're just blasted out into the world, and it's unbelievable, because like we were talking about before, it's the opportunity for people to get for them to see your work, and that is a double-edged sword, you know? So it's both wonderful and terrifying, and... I have done a lot of growing in the past month. It's been out for a month, and I've really had some deep conversations with myself about who I am as a person and the validation that I need and the things that are going to move me forward as an artist. Because I feel like if you don't get comfortable with it very quickly, you probably just won't make anything again.
Yeah. And so you're still waiting to hear about season 2, you said?
Yeah, we're still waiting to hear about season 2. I think that everyone knows it's gone really well. Mm-hmm. And
I love that they're like 11-minute episodes, right?
Yeah, they're all different lengths. I think the longest one is 18 minutes and the shortest one is 12 minutes. And that was the great thing about pitching it to Black Pills. It's also the great thing about Netflix is that they bought it as is. They didn't make one change, and you know, really celebrated a lot of the decisions that we had made with the show, which was really cool. And you know, the music was written by this guy, Adam Crystal, who's a wonderful composer, and just the team that we had around us making this thing. It feels like we were all in this one particular place in our career, and this show being seen by so many people has given us a lot of opportunity to make more stuff.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to see more from you, writer. Can we endorse real quick?
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement for the week is Fleabag season 2. Are you guys watching this show?
I saw the first one. I need to see the second one.
So the first season is great.
Yeah.
Second season is incredible. It's like genuinely the thing I am the most excited about right now. I've been, you know, slowly doling it out because like it would be easy to just watch them all in one sitting. And I'm really trying to take my time on it. But Fleabag season 2 is really, it's everything that's great about the first season and then some. So, writer, do you have anything?
I was like, wonder if anyone's ever said this, but I think you should leave with Tim Robinson. Have you seen that?
Love it. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Did you endorse that, Matt?
Maybe once.
Did you already endorse it?
But that's okay. God. It's good to double down on it though.
Honestly, yeah. Double down on it. I would come back and say it again. It's also on Netflix, but if the first segment of the guy opening the door does not sell you, then I don't think that you have a comedic bone in your body. It is the funniest thing I've ever seen. I was so thrilled. It reminded me of like sketch comedies, Strangers with Candy, like just sort of these warped world ideas. I just love people who are so wholly themselves that are making things that say like, get into the joke or don't get in it.
Yeah. And also, again, like 15-minute episodes.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, bite size. That first scene is a shot at Brew, which is the coffee shop right down the street from me.
Fun fact.
Yeah. So I think you should leave season 1 on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah. Oren, what you got?
We talked about Dead to Me.
No, pretty good. Yeah, there you go.
I'm enjoying that.
Yeah.
On Netflix.
Yeah, too. Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, check out Dead to Me.
Dead to Me season 1.
Season 1.
There you go. Yeah, I love Linda Cardellini.
My friend Max Jenkins is on it.
Oh, right. Oh cool. Yeah. Who does Max play?
Gay guy.
There you go.
Choir.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I can't. It's on my list. As soon as I'm done with Fleabag, I'm going
to get
there.
There's so many dark shows on right now.
Yeah, well, the thing about, not to talk about Fleabag too much, but it's both funny and gut-wrenching in the same episodes.
Right. Yeah. That's what I like. Take me there. Yeah. But it's good. I mean, these spaces like Netflix are giving people the opportunity to create a bunch of different types of shows. I think a lot of people are now bemoaning the fact that there's so much content out there. But honestly, it's like, find what you like and watch it. Like, what a wonderful supermarket of like opportunity.
Well, writer, where can we learn more about you, follow along, and make sure that we get to see Bonding season 2 and whatever else is coming from you next?
Well, my Instagram is writerdoyle@gmail.com, writerdoyle at gmail. I'm not really
on. That's your Instagram?
Yeah, that's my Instagram.
Oh, good. I thought you were giving away your email address.
No. Oh, did I say my email?
You said @gmail.
Oh, @gmail. That's funny. No, it's not. It's actually not.
Oh, good.
Writerdoyle. You don't even have to cut that because it's actually not. But maybe I should set that email up and see who emails me.
Yeah,
you should. Wait, but what is your Instagram?
Oh, my Instagram is writerdoyle. Writerdoyle.
There you go.
R-I-G-H-T-O-R-D-O-I-L-E.
I never type it in.
You never have to tag yourself.
Yeah, so yeah. R-I-G-H-T-O-R-D-O-I-L-E. And then I think it's the same thing on Twitter, but I don't really go on Twitter. It's a true hellscape.
And is Writer your birth name?
It's my middle name. It's my great-grandmother's maiden name, but I'm from New Orleans, and a lot of people in my family go by their middle name.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
Great.
Well, thanks so much for doing the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, if you want to learn about more of the stuff that we talked about on the show, you can visit justshootitpod.com for our show notes. You can follow us across social media at justshootitpod. We're Instagramming a ton. We're tweeting a bunch. It's a good way to keep yourself in the loop on what's happening with the show, both special events and also new episodes. And if you want to leave us a voicemail like Jeff from Olympia at the top of our episode, you can give us a call at 2626-SHOOT-1. Operators are standing by. I really love the voicemails. They're the best.
Yeah. Email us too, justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find me. I'm @okaplan on Instagram.
And I'm @MrMattEnlo on all the things.
And rate us on iTunes. We really love it.
Yeah, it's pretty great. This episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe, produced by Madeline Rosewatt, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to right now is by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.